Hello, young lovers, whoever you
are. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Call us at 1-888-429-5471 and join us anytime you want. Barbara Berger with us is the author of The Awakening Human Being, A Guide to the Power of the Mind. She's an American-born best-selling author of The Road to Power, Fast Food for the Soul, published in 30 languages. She's also the author of Are You Happy Now? 10 Ways to Live a Happy Life, and also The 10 Mental Laws, Mental Technology, Gateway to Grace, the Spiritual Pathway. And let's say, Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. How is the weather in Denmark? What time is it there?
It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's cold and snowy.
Oh, no. Okay, but at least you're inside all wrapped up so we can talk.
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right, let me ask you this. We talk about the mind. The mind's a very interesting thing, and there's more and more information coming out about it. And most of life as we know it today is based on a choice. But there are choices that we don't know that we have. And I really believe people like yourself who get into this and begin to explore and get into those unknown horizons that the mind and all those choices that the mind has to offer open doorways for us. And the average person, how much about the mind does the average person truly really know?
That's the reason why I write all these books, because I've discovered that most people are really unaware of the incredible power of their mind. So this information, the information that's in my books that you're talking about, is so life-transforming, is so self-empowering. But unfortunately, most people don't know this stuff. So they are actually, you could say, innocent victims of the way their minds work, because they don't really understand how their minds work.
Okay, let's take you back when you first got your moment of discovery, quote-unquote. What is it about the mind that you discovered that we could put to practical use?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand, and this is what I found out, of course, is that we never really experience reality directly. We only experience our stories, or you could say our interpretation of the events that are unfolding before us. And usually we're so identified with our thinking, our stories, that we don't realize that the event has not got the same meaning as we are putting into it. And so we are somehow victims of forces that we don't really understand. But when we see that there's actually a difference between our thinking and events, our thinking and reality, then we suddenly have a choice. We can look at our thinking and we can ask ourselves, well, is this a sane, productive way to regard the situation? Or maybe I should look at things in a different way. So we gain flexibility, we gain a new freedom, we gain power to take control of our lives. So it's a very, very important issue for all of us.
Well, let's put it in two different ways. Let's say, for instance, that I was brought up in a way that I experienced that love is pain. And if I meet
what
somebody...
What did you experience?
Okay, what if I was brought up, hypothetically now, I wasn't, but let's say I was brought up to believe that love was pain. You fall in love, they're going to beat you up, or they're going to walk out on you.
And
I've got this reality going that if I fall in love, there's pain. Well, I'm living in a world, in my mind, that really doesn't exist for that person that I meet, and that in and of itself can put me at the mercy of my past experience in life. One more thing before I want to finish this statement. It was Carl Jung who said it, that he said, most of us mistake reality for assumptions. An assumption may have an incontestable conclusion. So you take it on as a reality, and you're living your life based on assumptions that has nothing to do with the current event, and you get into a lot of trouble.
I totally agree. I usually tell the story, let's just take a concrete example. Another one similar to what you're saying. Say, let's take divorce, right? That's something that's a big issue for many people. If you look at what the reality of a divorce is, it's actually, the reality is two people who live together, they've now separated. That's what a divorce is. And for one person, they have the story that divorce is, you know, the end of the world, I'll never find anybody again. I'll always be alone. I'll never have love again. And so they go into deep depression. Another person gets divorced, and it's like, hallelujah, finally I'm free. I got rid of the guy, you know. So, but the divorce itself, the reality of the divorce is still two people who live together are now separated. So you really don't experience just the event. You experience your interpretation of the event. So that's the incredible power of the mind. And so you could say that, okay, in the divorce situation, if you have this very catastrophic interpretation of a divorce, maybe it's not serving you so well. Maybe you want to question your story. Is it true that I'll never experience love again? Is it true that I'll be alone for the rest of my life? Is it true? And you start to see that maybe your thinking is not so productive for the life you want to live.
Okay, but you have to realize that there are, not you in the general sense of the word, and this is what you've done. You've got to realize that there are, quote-unquote, alternatives, roadmaps to get to particular places. Let's call something a law, you know, a rule to follow. And if you follow the rules, if you understand the way, the dynamic, the way that the mind works, then you can work with it.
Well, that's exactly why I wrote this book, exactly what you're saying. My book is called The Guide to the Power of Mind. And actually, the whole first section of the book is what I call the mental laws. Because I found out that the way the mind works is an impersonal mechanism that we can all study and learn. And in fact, I'd like to tell our listeners that if you're interested in these mental laws, you can download them for free on my website, www.beamteam.com. I have tried to map out the way the mind works, and I call it the mental laws. And I try to show that it's an impersonal mechanism that's something that's affecting all of us, but because we're not aware of it, we're kind of victims of this. But if we learn about it, then we can actually use it to benefit ourselves. So these mental laws that I describe, and which you can download on my website, they are impersonal mechanisms like physical laws, like the law of gravity, any kind of law that affects all of us. You could say, for example, that the law of gravity, it affects all people whether or not we're aware of the fact that there's a law of gravity. I mean, if you stand on top of a building and you jump off, you're going to fall down whether or not you know the law of gravity exists. And it's the same with the mental laws. It's the same with the way the mind works. So I think the fact that so many of us are starting to wake up to this information is so exciting, because that means big change is going to happen for a lot of people.
Well, I think one of the things we're dealing with also, if people say, I can't find happiness, I want to be happy, and you know the list goes on and on. But if you don't think that you have the ability and the power and the wherewithal to create happiness, just look at the other side of it and look what you've done to yourself, you know, with the pain and the rest of it that goes along with it. So what I'm really hearing you say, it's a shift of thinking. Anything that happens in my life, me personally, I'm responsible for it, based on how I saw it in the past, based on the emotional connection unconsciously that I may have toward a particular subject that's going to cause me to react in a particular way. So what I'm hearing you say, it's changeable if you follow the law.
Yeah, it's changeable. You first of all have to become aware of what's going on. And when you become aware, you actually start to have options. It's exactly as you said. You start to be able to see that there is actually a difference between reality and your thinking. I mean, that's really a key point. When you can suddenly see that, because you can see it, you suddenly realize you have options. You suddenly realize that the value of events is not something that's inherent in the event itself. It's actually something that you superimpose upon it. So that if you are unhappy, you might want to question, is this really true? Is this unhappiness really inherent in what's going on? Or are there other options for me here? So that's very self-empowering. I mean, I work as a therapist, so I see what this awareness does for people. It's like suddenly, wow! You know, suddenly it's like, you mean I can actually do something about this situation? So
And I have found, which I thought was kind of interesting, somebody gave me a great example of this year, probably 35 years ago, actually, which was a great example about unconsciously activating an emotion and reacting to it, good or bad, at that moment that you're reacting to what's going on in front of you at this time. It's something that might have happened a week ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago. Okay, you're still going through it. And what they said was the prime example would be driving down the highway of life with your hands on the rear view mirror, steering your life. You get into a tremendous amount of accidents. But if you take a simple shift in the way you think and you put your hands on the steering wheel, that simple shift all of a sudden brings you into today, and you're not at the effect of yourself.
Yeah. It's a great story. Yeah. So it's so exciting to actually to get to work with these. I mean, also personally, what it's done for my own life, and then sharing this information with other people and seeing how other people really turn their lives around. It's just so wonderful. And actually, what I'm hoping is going to happen soon is that we're going to start to teach this stuff to kids in school. I mean, we didn't learn this in school, so it's taken us our whole lives to figure it out. But now there's more and more people who are starting to understand this stuff. So it's something that we can soon start teaching our children on a regular basis. This will be so wonderful.
Yeah, there was a great story. My sister and I got into an argument, I don't know, a couple of years ago, whatever the case may be. It was one of those rip-roaring I hate you times, right? And I can't remember what it was, but I called her something. It wasn't a four-letter expletive. I said something like, you know, you're dependent. And then she looked at me and she said, you're a loser, okay? And then those weren't the words, but I can't remember, but they were like that. And I walked out of the room and I stopped and I started smiling. And I popped my head back in the door and I said, you know what just happened? She said, what? What I think about me, I called you. And what you think about me, you just called me. Yeah. And we both started laughing because that was the reality of it.
When
people get upset because somebody doesn't like me, somebody offended me, etc., if we really get that they're not offending you, they're offending themselves, and you get to be used to do so, we don't do anything about anybody else. It's all a reflection of ourselves.
Always. Yeah, that's also one of those great realizations when you get that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other thing is also, I mean, when you start looking at stuff like this, you can also say that when you start to understand these mechanisms, you can ask yourself, what is actually preventing you from being happy right now? Considering that everybody wants to be happy, that's sort of like our primary drive in life. If you really stop people up and say, well, what is actually preventing you from being happy right now? And it's like people that go, but when you actually ask people, it's always a story they have about something in the past or something in the future. It's never really anything that's going on in this moment. And that's also similar to what you're talking about. It's all these projections, either forward, backwards to other people, instead of resting at home with themselves and finding out that this moment is actually quite okay. So it's, again, this getting lost in the story, getting lost in your mind, and not really noticing that, you know, this moment is quite okay and everything is quite fine right now.
Yeah, and then we get into the, you know, we're starting to run out of time, but we get into the if only I had money, if only I had a relationship, if only I had this. And I think a great example of that is look at some of the Whitney Houston, who just, you know, who just passed away. What a waste.
Yeah,
what a,
I know.
Whatever. And you get people, the Michael Jacksons, the rest of them, they're making millions and billions of dollars, yet there's something missing, whatever that is, that causes them for the rehab, etc. So it's not if I only had money or if I only had this. It's called look in the mirror if you only had yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're really talking about also is that we live in a society, in a culture where we seem to have been programmed that our happiness depends on all these outer things. I mean, on money, as you say, and if you have the right husband or the right wife, if you have what a nice car you have, what a great job you have. I mean, and not that there's anything wrong with any of these things, but that they're all outer circumstances which change, which you can't control, which come and go, which, you know, sooner or later you're going to lose. So the true happiness, the happiness that's always there, that's unconditional, is actually the joy of life itself, which is what you are to begin with. So in a way, you could say we're seeking happiness in all the wrong places, too. But that's also the mind taking us in all these directions and all these stories that we're not questioning.
But that's the whole point, Barbara. I want to make sure we get this point. That's the whole point. It's, you were talking about the stories we tell each other, or we tell to ourselves. That's what you're dealing with those kids that become famous and can't deal with the fame, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're starting to run out of time. Barbara Berger, do you have a website we can find you at, buy the books, and follow you?
Yes, the website is www.beamteam.com. And as I said, you can download the Mental Laws for free on the website. You can buy the books and read all the other stuff there, too.
Dynamite. Hey, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for inviting me. God bless.
Yeah, you too. Good night.
Bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. After being a nurse, a realtor, and a full-time mom with two little boys, Lindsay Frucci founded No Fudge, that's Foods Inc., No Fudge Foods Inc., in her New Hampshire kitchen and served as chief cook and bottle washer for 10 years. And she lives in Brooklyn now with her husband and Zoe the dog. Let's say, Lindsay, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Michael. Good evening.
Oh, did I pronounce your last name right, Frucci?
You did, Frucci.
Frucci, I got it. I just want to make sure I got it. Okay, by the way, starting a business for so many people is frightening because they don't know how to start, what to expect, or what's going to happen. So when you decided to, quote unquote, bite the bullet and do it, what was that place for you when you got that moment that said, that's it, this is what I'm going to do?
I wish it had been quite that simple and that straightforward. We had gone through a bankruptcy. My husband's business had failed, and we were struggling, trying to find our way back to both financial and family happiness. I mean, it takes a real toll, as many people know these
sure.
days. And I felt a need to try and do something to help. And in my brain, that was start a business that would make a ton of money. And I had no idea what that would mean. I had no idea what that would entail. So it was a process of coming to understand that I needed help, what kind of help I needed, and then really taking baby steps forward. It was not one big aha moment.
No, but see, what I think in my heart of hearts and all the experience I've had over all of these years, when it really comes down to it, Lindsay, is this. You take someone who spent 10 years you know, falling down, getting up, falling down, getting up, finding the right way, making a mistake, fixing the mistake, and moving forward, and all of the struggle, and my goodness, it's struggle, that you have to go through to create a business.
It is.
But what happens if I can take your book and I can take advantage of everything that you'll show me how not to do, quote unquote, or what could happen? What took you 10 years, you can open up for somebody in a couple of 3 hours. Now, my feeling about it is this. For a lot of people, that's a tremendous gift. You get to anticipate what it is that you're going to walk into if you didn't know.
Well, that's true. And I think from that point of view, there are certainly some guidelines without question. And I think number one is that you must believe in you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe in not only yourself, which at that point in time I wasn't even sure I did. That took me a while to come to terms with that. But you have to believe in what it is you're going after. This is not one of starting a business, being an entrepreneur, is not the kind of thing that you sort of shrug and say, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. Yeah. It's too hard. It takes a lot of work. So from that point of view, I think you need to start out with a strong sense of belief in what you're going after. And sure. I think that's critically important. And for me, again, Michael, that was a process. I grew up in a house where I was told girls didn't need to go beyond high school.
Yeah.
And I was 44 when I started this. So when I say it was a process, it was not instantaneous. I needed to start the process in trying to believe in myself, and it started out really as me thinking, wanting to help out the family, and then slowly coming to the realization that I needed to do this to prove to myself as well as to anybody else that I could accomplish what I was setting out to do.
And most importantly, I think that the impetus behind the book, for people reading the book, deciding to go into business, I think that's really where I was at. What would have happened if somebody would have handed you this book when you started the business? I mean, I'm sure you would have made some mistake. We all would. But you would have looked at it a little differently. Yeah. That's where I was at.
Absolutely. And I hope that I've said to a few people that if I can motivate and inspire one person to believe in themselves enough to look at my story and say, wow, well, if she can do it, you know, no college, no money, no minimal support at home, if she can do it, so can I. And I would love to think that is a message that is in the book, and that, you know, if you can believe in yourself and that you need to find support systems and you need to find people who will also believe in you, and you need to feed off them. You need to use those people to convince yourself that you can do it. I would love to think, because it really is a story that I'm a smart person, and I learned how smart I was as I created my company and grew my company. But I'm no Steven Jobs. I'm not anything. I'm just a mom of two kids who was so determined that I wouldn't let no be the answer. And believe me, I fell down a lot. there were a lot of failures, you know.
But by listening to
you know, if you read the book, I mean, this was not, it sounds like a fairy tale to start a company in my kitchen and grow it to a multi-million dollar business. That sounds like just such a fairy tale, the American dream. But I fell down a lot. And the other message in the book is you have to keep getting up.
Oh, absolutely. But by the way, I would totally disagree with you that you're not a Jobs, because he did the same thing. He started with nothing, and look what he built. And it took the strength within himself to get it done. And I really believe that's it. And if you didn't make billions, you made what you made. So it was that same entrepreneurial, knew you could do it, and that was the end of it. You were going to do it. That's what propelled him to his success.
I guess you're right. It's hard for me to put myself, as you can imagine, in that same niche. But
sure.
But it is it's a determination and a willing to persevere. I mean, I had some just, and I guess coming to terms with the fact that there's no silver bullets. there are very few. There are the rare instances of people who have this idea and happen to speak to the right person at the right time, and it takes off, I guess. That didn't happen to me. It was a whole lot of long hours and long days and a lot of hard work. But I have to say that in the end, I found a person that I wasn't sure existed, and that was a me that I hadn't known before, a me that I liked a whole lot more, and a me that I respected a whole lot more.
Sure. Now, by the way, what time frame was this?
I was 44. It was mid-90s.
Okay, in the mid-90s. If you go back and you look at business, you know, Radio Susie and I joke about this all the time. Her late husband was in a union, and I got a hold of that union manual that he had. This thing was back in the 60s, that manual? Okay, but anyways, and it was Article 4, Chapter, whatever it was, basically said that no female shall take any male jobs over and so on and so forth. So, yes, there was that mindset for years and years and years, and, you know, quote, unquote, girls can't do that. Well, that's not so, because you have a mind, but you went over and above what you were taught. And I think that in and of itself, that's a jobs.
It is, and you know what? Thank you. I have to come to terms with being disappointed in myself a little bit. And it's one of those little things you deal with, in that I didn't question it sooner. I was 44 years old before I finally had the courage to stand up. And my husband had been raised in the same kind of environment I had, and I can't blame him for having the same stereotypical ideas that I had, and I bought right into it. And something clicked, and I wish I could tell you what it was, but something clicked at 44, and I looked around. I had two little boys, and my husband was gone Monday through Friday traveling, and I thought, I can do this. You know, but I had never questioned it before that. I had gone right along with, and I have to say, I had felt discontent at times. I had felt unsure of myself, uncertain, but never had I stood on my own. It was the first time I rebelled. So most people rebel at 16 or 15. I rebelled at 44, but I'm so glad I did.
No, by the way.
One of my biggest regrets is that I didn't have a daughter that I could tell to rebel. I had sons instead.
But that's okay. But that's a good role model for them also. And it's a good role model for their wives. And one of the great things about it, Lindsay, it's a legacy. And years and years and years from now, when you don't exist, it will, and so will the book be alive.
Yes, thank you. And I have to say, I really hope... My boys saw me in every role right along the line, and they knew that, they always knew, even when I wasn't there for birthdays or proms, and I did miss them because I was on the road traveling, they knew that how important they were to me. And we are great friends at this point, and they are, neither one is married, but they're great boyfriends. I mean, they are really good to the women in their lives, and I take credit for that. I have to admit.
And why not? And by the way, are they entrepreneurs?
Neither. Well, yes. Actually, my oldest son is. My oldest son went out on his own in his early 20s to write a blog, and now is writing a blog in New York called Split Cider that he owns 51% of and does all the creative, is 100% responsible for the creative. So, yes, he is. And I have to say, I think my greatest moment of satisfaction came. My youngest son was in an entrepreneurial program at Syracuse University. And in high school, it was always, I don't want this company, you know, sell no pudge. I have no interest in it. And he called me one day in his senior year of college and said, you know what, Mom? I had no clue what you'd done, and now I do. And that made me feel incredibly good, I have to say. As you can imagine,
Lindsay,
as a parent,
you know what you should be saying? You know what you should be saying to them, or what they should be saying to their friends? You said they wrote Rocky III after my mom.
Thank you.
That was that part in it where he's talking to his son, and he said, "Life—it's not how hard you get hit that makes you tough. It's getting hit and getting up and keep on going."
Up.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
I got it loud and clear.
That's
we're
exactly
just
right. And our kids have seen that in both of us.
Yeah.
You know, they have seen that, and I love the fact that we've given them that role model.
Wonderful. By the way, Lindsay, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at and get a hold of the book.
The website is Lindsay Frucci, LindsayFrucci.com. There's an excerpt from the book there, as well as other information and an ability to buy it right from the website, or you can get it on Amazon or any bookstore.
Wonderful. Hey, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And Susie, thank you too.
She said, you're welcome. Okay, good night.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Good night.
You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you wrong, yeah. You know you're gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you for you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Radio Susie, is this the magic line here? Is that what I'm looking for?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Author Lee Stryker is also with us. She's a mom of three, author and speaker on parenting and self-help issues. She's a graduate of Stony Brook University, where she received a bachelor's degree in mental health. She also holds a Sunbridge College master's degree for Waldorf early childhood education. These experiences, not to mention her 26 years of marriage, gives her an interesting take on the subject of staying married while also strong for the children and true to oneself. And she is the author of Living Happily Ever After, Separately, How Separate Spaces Could Save Your Marriage. Hi, Lisa. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, there's so many people today. You got a 55-60% divorce rate first time, and the second and third and fourth and fifth times, it gets worse than that. You know, what is that something that most people are missing? There's that whatever that connection is that they don't get, and maybe some separation could do the trick.
You know, Michael, I think what happens is that a lot of people, that connection gets buried. It gets buried underneath layers upon layers of just old resentments, bad habits, you know, bad patterning and bitterness. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people just don't realize that the love is still there. It's just really hard to find anymore.
I think one of the biggest problems also that we have today, and I haven't been to anybody's wedding in, I don't know, maybe 100 years now, but I remember weddings in the past. There was always that, you know, till death do you part, love, honor, and obey, and whatever, until political correctness came in, and you can't use those words anymore. You don't own me, and that's the end of it. So there's almost a separation walking in, and I really believe when it really comes down to it, in my heart of hearts, that people are frightened to death to be able to say, what did I say when I years ago I was married, and I was up at the university in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I said something about my wife, and there were two kids from the university, young women, 20-ish, sitting there, and she said, what do you mean my? You don't own her? And I looked at him, and I said, okay, bye. But that's where the problem is. You, what is a relationship today?
It's just so, so different than it ever was before. And I think that in and of itself has really confounded people and has brought in so many sort of conflicting agendas into what it takes to have a happy marriage and to have a sustainably happy marriage. There's just so much going on in our culture these days. And particularly, I think one of the points that I make in the book is that we are just more individual as individuals than we've ever been before. You know, and this is all being nourished and coaxed by popular culture. You know, we're encouraged to be self-centered. We're encouraged to be consumers. We're encouraged to think about what it is that we want, what makes us happy. And all of those things, I think, in large part work against what it takes to really be in a collaborative relationship with somebody where you're really sharing a vision and sharing a commitment. I think that's all just become a lot harder.
Sure. And I'll give you one of the reasons for it. You and I meet, we get a great attraction going, okay? Well, I don't want to tell you who I really am. I don't want to let you know what some of my faults are, some of my weaknesses are. So I'm going to be to you what I think that you're looking for. And then when we get together, the masks start to come off, you get more comfortable, and it's the same old story. Well, that's not the way you were when we met. That's not who you were. And I think we're forced into that in today's society.
I think you're totally right. And, you know, you almost just spoke a chapter out of my book, because that's really exactly what happened with my husband and myself. We, you know, we've met, we were attracted to each other. We had a lot in common. We had a lot of the same ideals and visions for our lives. And we were absolutely on our best behavior. And then we got married, and it didn't take long before reality started to reveal itself and all of the incompatibilities little by little started to rise up to the surface and ultimately over many years just really took over. I think it's totally natural and normal for people who are courting each other to put on their best face. And frankly, I think it's hardwired. I think that, you know, we are designed. I don't know whether we could actually consciously be otherwise, because otherwise, you know, I don't know whether people would get married, whether they would find each other and mate and, you know, propagate the species, as it were.
Oh, sure. I learned something, must have been a couple of years ago on the show. I was doing an interview, and it had to do with The First Kiss. That was the name of the book, you know, Make It or Break the Relationship. Uh-huh. And men are supposed to know how to kiss women. That's not necessarily true. I can't imagine that. I mean, I would do this today, but I can't imagine meeting somebody for the first time, going out on a date and saying, how do you like to be kissed? We're supposed to know this stuff. All right.
I
took it a step farther in my own head, and I thought about this. How many of us meet somebody, and you go out a few times, you like each other, okay, and you say, how do you receive love? We don't do that. Prime example, you and I meet, we get in this great relationship, and the way I've learned to receive love is a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something. And for you, hypothetically, if you buy you something, it means I love you. So 2 years go by, and I'm winking, and I'm looking at you, and I'm touching you, and I'm doing all the things that I know to be to show love. Well, 2 years later, I walk into the house, and you're packed up. I said, what's the matter? Well, I'm leaving. Why are you leaving? Well, you don't love me. I said, what do you mean I don't love me? You never show me.
Yeah. You know, that's a great illustration of another thing that I talk about in the book, just in terms of my relationship with my husband, is that he grew up in Germany, and I grew up in the northeastern United States. And even though on the outset it looked like we had so much in common and were very compatible, as we lived together over a number of years, it became really clear that our cultural upbringing really was very, very influential. And I think what you're talking about, Michael, with your particular cues as to how to give and receive love versus somebody else's, that's almost like a little subset, I think, of a culture. And, you know, you have your expectations and she has her expectations, and they don't necessarily meet and they don't necessarily harmonize. One of the things that I learned over many, many, many years of working on my marriage with my husband is that I have to be really, really clear about what it is I want. I cannot make any assumptions with him. You know, we were looking at what we were going to do for Valentine's Day this year. And I had to spend a couple of days thinking about what it was that I really wanted. And at first I thought, oh, gee, I'd love to go to a really expensive restaurant and get dressed up and everything, and wouldn't that be fun? And then I had to catch myself, Michael, because the fact is that none of that would be fun for my husband, because he just has a whole different outlook on this sort of thing. And so what I had to then do is say, okay, what would he enjoy and I enjoy, so that we could really both enjoy the experience together? And we ended up just having a lovely little home-cooked dinner, and I bought us a special dessert, and then we watched a movie together, and it was really, really sweet. In fact, we did it last night because I knew I was going to be busy with the interview tonight, so we had a little preemptive Valentine's Day.
Which is great. And what it really, I really believe this, and I thought this for so many years now, it's not where you go, it's who you're with. And exactly. When it really comes, yeah, you know, people say, I want to travel, I want to do this, I want to do that. For what? That doesn't mean that traveling isn't a good thing. But there's always that add-on. There doesn't have to be an add-on. And, you know, add-ons are great, but it doesn't have to be the add-on to enjoy yourself.
Exactly. That's just sort of the icing on the cake. You need the cake first.
Yeah. No, I completely and I totally agree. And the other side of that, if he was brought up in Germany, he's going to come from a different culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that culture, somebody wrote a book about, you know, do you shake hands? Do you touch somebody? What do you do in business for the first time in different countries? And it's going to be, the culture is going to be completely different. What he's learned to, not now, you two have been together, but what he would have learned for acceptance is going to be something completely different here. There are cultures where you can't look at anybody in the eyes. You got to drop your eyes. Otherwise, you're insulting them. So there's that to move through also.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think as young girls, as young women, we develop this fantasy of the perfect man who will just sweep us off our feet and will anticipate our every desire and our every need. And, you know, we won't have to say a thing. He'll just magically know what we want. And it doesn't happen like that. Maybe it does for a few people. But I think that the more we can just sort of wake up from that fantasy and get clear about what it is we need and what it is we want and be able to communicate that effectively to our partners, the sooner we're going to have a harmonious relationship and just, you know, be contented in and of ourselves as well.
And absolutely. And it's also how somebody takes in, they perceive, you know, the way they've learned to process what you're saying. Prime example, you say to him, did you take out the garbage? Is it a question or an accusation? It could be, yes, I'm cleaning the house up, or a fight for the entire night.
Uh-huh. Well, see, you know, you bring up taking out the garbage. Interestingly, now that Emil and I are living separately, that's not an issue The garbage isn't an issue. I take out my own garbage. He takes out his own garbage. So, you know, this is one of the little things that is no longer getting in the way of us enjoying each other.
But can you eventually come back together, or is this the way it's going to be?
Well, you know, we actually spend half of the week together, either at my house or at his house. Generally, it's four nights, and we spend the night and we eat together and all of that. And it's the nights before my school days, my teaching days, that I stay in my house and he stays in his. So we are very much together, and we talk pretty much every day on the days that we don't stay together. But in terms of looking toward the future as to whether we will one day get back together, whether this is just a trial separation, you know, I don't think either of us knows the answer to that, Michael. I think we just need to wait and see. And right now what we are doing is celebrating the fact that we have each gotten our lives back, and we have been able to renew our marriage. We have been able to just sweep away all of the nastiness and all of the bitterness and all of the toxicity, and really enjoy and appreciate each other in a way that we hadn't been able to do for probably about 20 years.
You know, by the way, one of your talking points I think is interesting. You know, the perfect man we dream about may not actually be a man. I remember I was 16. I'm not sure quite how to take that one, but let me give one slant on it.
Okay.
When I was 16 years old, I was absolutely in love, right? The last love of my life, of course, right?
Uh-huh.
And she's breaking up with me. I remember sitting in the car. I can still see it. And she found an older man. He was 17 and in college, right? And she said to me, "You'll never be the man so-and-so is." And I remember those words to this day.
Oh,
and but when I was 16 years old, what went through my head was, well, I could kick his butt, right? That was a man at 16 years old. Today, I realize what a man is somebody who handles the responsibility of their own actions, the responsibility of their emotions, and it's, you know, the list goes on here. So the man of your dreams, in one aspect, may not, quote-unquote, be a man at all, because you may have two definitions of what a man is. And then the other side of that, the man of your dreams may not actually be a man at all, because it could be the same sex.
Uh-huh. You know, it's funny that you say that, because that didn't occur to me at all when I wrote that. I was really thinking about a man, but what I'm saying in that proposition is that, you know, it might be some sort of divine masculine part of yourself.
Sure.
And I write about in my book that I had a series of recurring dreams that were so powerful for me, and they were dreams of a man whom I didn't know, and he was very, very tall, and he just adored me, and he just held me, and for so long I thought, you know, there is somebody out there waiting for me. There is this soulmate out there. I need to get away from this miserable marriage. But, you know, after a number of years of this dream, I came to the realization that that man in the dream was really a man.
Let me hold you up. Before you say the realization, you know who that man was?
What?
You.
He might have been me, but the other idea that I had is that He was my guardian angel.
Okay. But the other side of that, absolutely. But the point of contention is dreams are symbolic.
Yes.
And every phase and facet of a dream, if you're dreaming about a table, it's you. And my contention is that one that, you want that whoever that is to come along, it's you. And maybe your guardian angel in and of itself is that soul part of you that you haven't connected with. And I really believe when a dream occurs constantly like that, the first person to connect with is yourself, and then you can go out and reconnect, and then the dream stops because you've accomplished it.
I think you're right. I think you're totally right.
Yeah, and it's just whatever the case may be. And the idea here is where there, quote unquote, where there's a will, there's a way. The most important thing between the two of you. And I bet he's listening and taking notes, because you're going to get it tomorrow for this one. But
he's downstairs eating dinner.
Oh, okay. But when it really comes down to it, you've at least got to a place where you have something that's workable that most people who are going through the problems do not have.
Exactly.
Yeah, and yeah. Who knows what's going to happen?
That's right. Who knows? But what we have right now is working so well, not only for me and Emil, but also for our whole family, for our girls. You know, when I think about what it would have been like if we had divorced, you know, it just would have been so, so painful. And we are all so grateful that we managed to avoid that travesty.
No, and it's a good thing. And one, I've said this, I think, earlier in one of the interviews tonight, but it's so true. When you put your heart and soul into a book, and somebody can read that book and be able to anticipate the possibility of some kind of a challenge and how to work their way through it, it stops a lot of grief because they know how to do it before it happens to them. Or they watch and they know what the signs are, and based on the signs, they maneuver, they navigate around it.
Yeah, it's so, you know, that's what part of being part of humanity is really just sharing your experience and sharing your wisdom and hopefully helping other people find their way.
Yeah, no question about it. And as a matter of fact, when you really come down to it, when you take a look at dreams and people and so on and so forth, I really believe the answer to everything is in the mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's really where it's at. Lisa, we're just about out of time. Can we get a website that we can find you at?
Yes, www.lisastrykerstussel.com, and that's LISTRYKERSTOESSEL.com, and thanks for asking.
Oh, and wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I saw the picture, you guys, on the website. You look cute together.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms, and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Where are you with a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old? Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover. so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Stacey Howson with us. She is the co-creator of Whale Communicators, the Dolphin Human Whale Connection, which is a DVD. She's an instructional designer and an e-learning developer. And she met her co-creator on a healing journey of her own. And it was initially, it was her co-creator's book that helped Stacey transform her life with animal communication and strengthened her connection to the web of life. And let us say, Stacey, how welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, and thank you both there?
Nope, it's just me. I say us as in the whales and me and the dolphins.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, you know, life is a big us, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. What was it? What was it for you, Stacey? What was it that... what was missing? What was it that when you got involved in it and you began to see it, you began to experience it and feel it, what was it that you saw that you didn't see before?
You know, Michael, I don't recommend that people have life hit them in a brick, run them into a brick wall like happened with me. I had eight deaths in a 14-month period of time, and it just took me to my knees, and life as I knew it stopped. I walked away from a very abusive family situation and lost 50 relatives, too. So I just worked 60 to 70 hours a week. And during this time, animals started coming to me all the time. My father was one of those that passed, and he just was the rock in my life. And he particularly loved bald eagles and deer. And bald eagles started appearing everywhere for me. They would literally fly by my house 20 feet out from my window and turn their head and look at me in the living room. And deer started appearing, dolphin. We have dull porpoise in Puget Sound here in Washington. And the dull porpoises started coming by, orcas started coming by, river otters. And I really, for that first year, stayed to myself, and the animals just kept on coming around me. And I started having some problems with behavior with my male cat, with my female cat. And a friend of mine had recommended to me, I was wanting to do an e-learning DVD in my field about orcas because of my passion. And my friend recommended I check into trans-species communication. And I went to a bookstore, and they said, oh, you want Communicating with Orcas, the Whale's Perspective by Mary Gettin. And I said, you mean there's actually a book out on the market about this? And they said, yes. So I bought the book, and I finished it on Christmas Day. And the messages that this beautiful orca named Granny, who is a member, she's the matriarch of J-Pod, of the Southern Residence Pod in Puget Sound here. The messages that she was giving to the human race started a revolution in my heart. And just her messages were just so piercing to my heart. I was like, I have got to find a way to get Granny's messages out to the world. And Mary, in the back of her book, had her email address and said that she still did animal communication consultations. So I thought, I'm going to contact her about my two cats, because I had never done this before. I'd heard of pet psychics. I hadn't heard of animal communication, and I had a lot of doubt as to whether or not it could be done. But I had a behavior problem in my household that was no longer tolerable for peace in my house. So I wrote Merry Christmas Day, and she returned my email the next day. Within 2 days, we were sitting down for communication with my cats.
Now, by the way, how did that work? I've got four of the little monsters running around here, and we communicate. And there, every once in a while, there's a problem, and sometimes I can feel it, and sometimes I can't. And they actually, when I say talk, I don't mean they literally talk, but they communicate. There's three dogs and four cats running around here, and it's a menagerie. But at the same time, if you're around them long enough, they've got souls. They make decisions. They do all those things.
Oh, Michael, I so agree with you, and especially with cats, dogs too. You can just see the energy around them, and you can feel it. Mental animal communication is mental telepathy, and it has also been described to me as feeling through your heart. So a gray whale told me in a communication once, humans need to get out of their heads and into their hearts. So we recommend to everybody, you know, bring it down from your head level. Filter all your information out through your heart for that. So definitely with animals, it's the way that Mary taught me and that we are teaching people in our e-learning DVD is we've got four guided meditations. And the one that I prefer is a grounding meditation where you run a cord from your base chakra down into the core of Mother Earth. And then you start bringing the energies of the Earth back up through the cord and up through all your chakras and out your crown chakra. And then you call on the animal that you want to communicate with. If something else wants to come in, you don't force the animal that you're going to talk to. You let whatever else wants to come in, and you begin asking questions.
Let me make sure I'm tracking, because so realistically there it's not just a connection with the animal, it's a total connection of everything. And I say everything, you know, from the soul forward. Stop and get out of your head, stop thinking and start feeling, and quote unquote go with your gut, which most people won't do because they'll think themselves out of it because of something might happen, yada yada. And so when you're talking about that core into the earth and moving through your body to those energy centers, what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, but you're doing a connection with really all that there is.
Oh, thank you so much for stopping me and clarifying that. You summed it up beautifully. Exactly. It is our connection to the web of life. It is the universal energies coming back up through the cord, and you basically now are connected to everything in the web of life. Michael, with animal communication or mental telepathy, you can not only talk to animals, you can talk to humans this way, you can talk to nature, plants, rocks. Everything in the web of life communicates through this language. It's the universal language.
But in that language, am I not, and this is a question now, I'm not all that versed in it, but in that language, am I not, if the web of life, am I not the web of life? Are you not the web of life? Is this chair that I'm sitting on not the web of life? So in essence, what you're really doing is you're getting feedback from yourself through the animals, because when you do that, there's not a separation between the two of you. You're the same.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you on that.
I have no idea what I just said, but that's what it felt like.
We are all interconnected.
Yeah, no, I got it. No, loud and clear.
Yep.
You got it.
And Michael, with mental telepathy or animal communication, if we want to say specifically, you know, in the beginning, it is so easy to doubt yourself, and doubt will negate any messages that you're getting. You've really got to be confident and positive about what's coming. Doubt can just kind of, it's like hanging up a telephone. And people receive these messages in different ways. Some people see like a video running through their head. Some see a series of pictures. Some actually get words, and some get feelings, or people get a combination of all of them. And a lot of times, I think over time, the more experience you have, the more of all these ways that the messages start coming to you through mental telepathy or animal communication.
And by the way, a very simple way to exemplify that is this. It's like with my dog. He's 105 pounds. He thinks he's a 3-pound poodle, but he's he's 12 years. No, he's 10 years old now, going on 11 years old. But when he wants to play, you can see he gets a smile on his face, and you can almost experience him talking to you. You know, let's go play. Throw a stick. Do this. Or they'll come in, and he'll say, I want a cookie now. But it's the same thing, and most people gloss right over that, not realizing that they are connecting, they are talking.
Oh, you really are good at this already. I believe that's the beginning stages of animal communication. You know, you're seeing, you're feeling, and although it may not be in words, yeah, it's already happening. A great example is like with the whales or dolphins. When people see a whale or dolphin and they don't know how to communicate, when they leave that animal is in their heart for a while. That energy is so strong. And in my opinion, that's already the beginning of animal communication. That is the heart-to-heart connection.
You know, there was, I'm going to say something, and I can't prove this, and there's no way that that I would know one way or the other. But as you're talking, I'm starting to think about that. The young woman that was killed about a year or so ago with the whale, the orca?
Yes, Dawn. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, let me tell you what I just experienced with that. She asked him to do it. And I really believe that it wasn't the whale. It was a combination of the two of them at the right time, the right place, and somewhere in her head, that was there, and they communicated. I mean, prove it? No, I have no idea. But that's my take on it.
You know, Mike, my soul, from my own practice clearing Akashic Records, would say you're spot on. I think it was a soul contract that they brought to the world to teach the world something about this. Tillicum, we communicated with him. We had two other communicators besides myself talk to him. Mary was one of them and Jennifer Parks. And it was just absolutely heartbreaking, Michael. Tillicum was like, I don't know what happened. I just snapped. He said she was so good to me. She was wonderful to me. I loved her. But he said he was going absolutely mad in captivity and that he didn't know what happened, but it just, his mind snapped and he just lost it and didn't remember anything till after it was all over.
Yeah. But I really believe it takes a combination of, nobody consciously says I want to die. I mean, there's no question about that. But in the end result, if that's what's going to happen to you, you'll bring yourself to it. I have believed over all of the years that I've been on this planet, it's been a couple now, that you get exactly what your innermost wish is. You want happiness? Yes. You want sadness? Yes. You want fear? Yes. You want pain? Yes. You want pleasure? Yes. And you get exactly what it is unconsciously that you're looking for based on your entire life experiences.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think we totally draw the energy to us that we concentrate the most on in our heads. And if it's fear, if it's anger, if it's hatred, you're just going to be ordering up more of that from the universe. It'll take your order and it'll serve it right up to you.
Yeah. And the interesting part about that, you know, the secret and all the hype that went on about the secret and, you know, the law of attraction and so on and so forth. If anybody doesn't think that that's true, if they're living a miserable life, guess what you brought to you? If it works for the good stuff, it also works for the bad stuff.
It does. And, you know, I've in my coaching with clients and talking with people that have bought the DVD, from my childhood, I really had to get out of the negative self-talk because I had so much of it. So, you know, when you do that negative, when that negative thing comes out of your mouth, stop yourself right there, and what I'll do is I'll immediately switch it up to two or three things that are positive. and I'll turn it right around for the universe. And it just takes work and diligence and paying attention to it and just turning it around immediately and putting it back out to the universe in accordance with how you want to receive.
Oh, no question about it. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Stacey, is there a website we can find you at? Get the DVD, more information.
Yes, there is. It is Whale Communicators, W-H-A-L-E, communicators with an S, .com. And if you go to whalecommunicators.com/DVD, it'll give you all the information about our computer-based training in our e-learning DVD, Michael.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for inviting us. Have
Take
a great care. Evening.
You too. Good night.
Okay.
I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
All right, bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Hello. Hello. Anybody there?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Peter Fairfield with us. He is the author of Deep Happy, How to Get There and Always Find Your Way Back. He's taught meditation, Qigong, Chinese medicine, acupuncture, East-West neuroenergetic physiology, German Peter, I'm going to have to fall on homeopathy, but I can say it, and other transformational systems. He studied spiritual and healing systems in Nepal, Tibet, India, Thailand, and China, and worked with many great Tibetan lamas and yogis, and he's been the acupuncturist at the Eastern Institute, founded an acupuncture school, taught acupuncture to the doctor, the king of Bhutan, and toured with Pink Floyd and other celebrities. And at one time, he was also a biofeedback therapist at UCLA. And Peter, hi, welcome to the show.
Boy, that was a mouthful. I forget I did all that stuff sometimes.
Yeah, I'm going to say, and in your
so good to be with you tonight.
Oh, hey, by the way, thank you. I almost couldn't get out homeopathy through my mouth, but we were close there. By the way, with all that experience, all right, what did that lead you to? What was the overarching theme that you found that was that pathway to get right down to it and eliminate the challenges and the blocks that cause people not to be happy?
Well, you know, the thread that put all that together is when I was a little boy, like probably many of your listeners, I had some profound spiritual experiences. So I was always trying to find out what spirituality was and how to get people happy. And so basically what I got from all that was a very interesting look at personality, the physiology behind personality, in other words, how it works. When I lived in Nepal, I saw a lot of people going into long retreats, sometimes 3-4 years. Many times, if they were had kind of an unpleasant personality going in, they may have an unpleasant personality coming out, but there was something about them that shimmered. And so that whole background allowed me to really think about what was the shimmer and what was the personality. Well, eventually I discovered that shimmer is a core essence that each of us has. And when we talk about somebody with a spiritual development or spiritual enlightenment, it's really that shimmer is the primary vehicle for their expression into this world and this plane. So basically that background allowed me to look at it, simplify it. And that's really what Deep Happy is about. Deep Happy is about finding the place inside us that's already happy. And,
okay, now...
you know, finding the place in... Yes?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I heard you get the... You paused for a second, but that's the whole point. It's the, and I'm sure with all of your expression or experience, the word happy. Don't we have to have a model for happy? Don't we have to have an idea what it looks like before we can recognize it within ourselves or externally?
Well, we're trained that way. You know, we're trained that if you get something, you know, that you want, you're happy. Or if you take something away that you don't want, you're happy. Or that if something hurts you, you're not happy, or and so forth. But have you ever seen a baby see something beautiful? Or have you ever looked at a cloud? Or have you ever had somebody hug you, and there's this incredible feeling? Well, you didn't have to have a model for that. There was something that came up inside you. One time I was in Maui, and we were sitting in the grass looking at the ocean, and I swear to God this is true. There was a little mouse that had crawled up on a stalk of grass, was hanging and looking out at the ocean. Now, it's hard to say a mouse was happy or not, but there was a sublime look on that mouse's face, and we were all watching the same sunset. There's something inside us that's innate. And, I mean, we practice this all the time. Writing the book, I had a problem with the IRS. They said I owed a lot of money, and which I didn't. But I was able to find this core of me that was okay, and I could kind of hang out there while the rest of me was sort of nervous and handling things. It made
yeah, but that's
difference.
The whole point.
Well,
let's jump in, Peter, just for a second. That's the whole point. You owed money. You were nervous about owing the money, but it had nothing to do with who you are.
That's right. That's right. Because I could still shimmer, and I could enjoy it.
Yeah.
I didn't have to take it so personally. You know, that's the thing. We take, like, so personally. Somebody doesn't like us, or we lose something. We don't get a possibility. And we hook our cart to that. But there's another part of us that's just fine. And the wonderful, interesting part, the part that's really the miracle, is that shimmering part is the part that's connected to the universe.
Sure.
So as soon as we begin to live in that part, or at least be able to find it, we find that there are these incredible messages and information and guidance that's coming from every part of every sector of the universe to us personally all the time. And that's where the real magic is.
And I really believe when you come down to it, that when we talk about life in and of itself, and you started to allude to this, but it's not what you have, it's not what you're going to get, you know. And goals are wonderful; there's no question about that. But if you can't stand up in the middle of an absolute mess and look in the mirror and wink at yourself, then there's the problem. That's where people fall down. They fall down in business. They fall down in your relationships. They fall down all over the place because I got to have this to do that. Well, what if you don't have to have anything to do that? I think that's really where the key is. The most important thing that we don't
that's
get taught. Yeah, go ahead.
That's right, and that's exactly what Deep Happy is. There's a quick story in Deep Happy. You know, I had met the publisher of Wiser Books, and she'd want me to write a book for several years, and she'd show up a couple times a year going, "You got to write something?" And finally, about a year and a half ago, I got this idea for Deep Happy, and in 1 week, a chapter and outline came in. 3 weeks later, I got a check. Well, every day I'd come out in the morning going, what should I write? Oh, I can't write that. Oh, I can't write that. After 6 weeks, I was ready to send the money back. I went for a walk. I live on a mountaintop in California, and I turned the corner, and here's a beautiful valley in this giant Mount Tamalpais where I live, and I just bent down and put my hands to my heart and said, what do I need to do to write this book? And this deep, booming voice appeared in my head that said, it's not the Bible. Yeah. And so I just broke out laughing right there because I realized I'd made it so serious and so hard. So I couldn't find it in myself, but I asked nature, I asked the great universe, and it spoke right to me. And we all have that. And that's also the essence of Deep Happy. It's all right there.
I think one of the roadblocks to Deep Happy is not being simple in your life. Life is simple. It is not complex. And people want to make it complex. There's a cat fighting with me for the microphone. But the complexity in life, she's going to win. The complexity in life really comes down to this, that if I make it complex, then I don't have to make a decision, and you can't judge me for that decision that I'll make. There is nothing wrong with simplicity, and simplicity is like this. You're walking to the doctor's office and your bicep hurts. So you put your arm up and you make a muscle and you say to the doctor, "Doctor, it hurts when I do this." And then he looks at you and says, "Well, don't do that." That's life. It's simple.
That's right. The power, if you study any kind of physics or metaphysics or qigong or energy work or concentration, you find that the power is in the simplicity. You know, you can have the most complex, turbo Maserati, but the thing that makes it powerful, and this is analogous from an old Buddhist reference, is that it's the hole in the hub of the wheel that allows the wheel to spin, that makes all that complexity roll down the road. And when we find the simplicity inside us, life gets simple.
Yeah, I was having some breathing problems probably, 15, 16 years ago. And I was at a chiropractor's office. And before I had, there was a friend of mine who happened to have been Chinese. It was the professor up at the university, and he said, if you could only find somebody to teach you Qigong, and he said, but they don't do it here. And I said, okay. So I went to the chiropractor's office the next day, and I'm standing there in the lobby waiting for her, and I happened to look up at the board, and you know what it said? There was a master from China coming in to teach Qigong.
There you go.
Yeah. And
the universe is supplying us with opportunities every moment. You've obviously learned that in your life.
Oh, big time. And really, when it really comes down to it, it'll come. And most of the time, I think more than anything else, it's like with what your book is about, quote unquote. I have it in front of me, but if I don't know how to recognize it, I'm going to pass it right by. So what does Deep Happy say? Here's how you recognize it.
That's right. Deep Happy is a process of beginning to notice the parts of ourselves where we don't live anymore.
Yeah.
Trauma and pain and suffering and difficulty and emotional things and disappointment. Many times we learn to shut off the feeling sense in our body. The Vedas from ancient India says the mind is the body. So much of what we think is our consciousness, our emotions, are really places in the body. And as soon as we start to pay attention to that, and this is a great deal what Deep Happy is about, we begin to discharge all of these negative feelings or the numb feeling in our body, and pretty soon our body begins to feel alive. And when our body feels alive, then we have vitality, we have energy, we have wisdom, because that's what anchors us into this plane. That's what puts us in this earth time. And it's so simple. We all want to do it. All you got to do is take a deep breath, and you begin that process. So Deep Happy is about the simplicity of that, and also details about how to do it and different areas to work on, how to get your heart open, also how to think about death, what karma is, and things like that in the more advanced part of the end of the book. But there's all kinds of practices about how to connect to yourself, how to connect to nature, how to listen for guidance. And then there's lots and lots of stories that from my life and experiences all over the world that sort of show how all these things work. So it's kind of a funny literary book, but also it's a really also a how-to book.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I've learned over all of the years is this, that the harder you get hit, if you can just take a breath and realize that it might not be fun going through at the time, and sometimes you may think that you're not going to get through it, there's something in it for you down the road. There's always something that comes out of it when you can finally stand back in a neutral ground, so to speak, and say, what did I learn? What did I walk into now that I wouldn't have gotten had that not happened, and so on and so forth. And I really believe if we begin to look at things, that doesn't mean that things coming at you and you getting hurt or emotionally, physically, whatever the case may be, is a great thing to go through. But beyond it, I think life is nothing more than one lesson after another. And when you finally recognize it and you see what it is you're supposed to learn, guess what? You get another one.
Exactly. You know, I like to say, you know, there's a chapter on karma in the book. And basically say that there's no such thing as bad karma or vindictive karma. Karma is just the love of the universe trying to wake us up. And if we come to the idea that everything that happens to us is a blessing, even though it may seem terrible, but what's the blessing? What's the benefit? If we keep finding that and looking for that, we discover that even the difficult things have, as you just said, have a great meaning and can enrich us and deepen us as humans and as people trying to create a sane life on this earth.
Yeah, and that's for so many people, Peter, that's very hard to fathom at the time what they're going through.
Yes.
You know, we've learned. Yeah, and that's what we've learned. We've learned to be a certain way. The culture today is not what the culture was 10 years ago or 50 years ago. It's a different culture. So you have to keep evolving and going through the learning process just to be a citizen on this planet based on wherever you are.
Yeah.
And I've felt this for many years now. If you can learn, if it's learned, the responses, if it's learned, you can unlearn and you can relearn, but you have to make up your mind to be able to do it and look beyond what you think is the monster right there.
Well, that's in the book Deep Happy. That's what the whole book is about. It's how to break through these things that we think are true, these things that we think is a particular reality that we're stuck in, and how to find the simplicity of walking your way back out. And it really just takes beginning to notice the places inside us that we forgot to notice, where the real truth is being spoken to us, where guidance of how to get somewhere and do something and accomplish something and solve something and survive is already just speaking to us all the time. That's really what the book Deep Happy is about. You couldn't have said it better.
Somebody said something to me once years and years ago, and they said, the key to everything is to stop resisting. And I remember looking at them like they were crazy. And the analogy that I got, which was good, was your body surfing down a river, and there is a big stone in front of you. If you resist the current, you're going to insert yourself in the stone. But if you don't resist, quote-unquote, go with the flow, you're going to go around the stone. And it's the resistance that causes the problem.
Right, steer, but don't resist.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You have to go around the stone, but you don't want to resist it. You can't. It's too powerful.
No, it's called go with the current. The current will take you around the stone. But if you resist the current, you get inserted into the stone.
Right, right. Yeah, because resistance takes so much energy and you don't get anywhere.
Yeah, and then you're off track.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no question about it. Okay, I pick up Deep Happy. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Peter, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I picked this book up?
Well, you realize, A, that you're already okay. You realize that other than buying the book, you don't have to get anything, you don't have to add anything, you don't have to become something you're not. You just have to go inside and, in a very simple way, find that everything you need to know what you need to do in your life to be okay is already right there. We do have an operating manual. You know, they say we don't come with one, but we do. And as soon as we begin to go through the numbness in our body, go through the places where we're not used to being, all of a sudden we find that we have everything we need and we're okay. And believe me, that it's a safe feeling. And people need to feel safe in this world right now.
And I think really when it comes down to it, it's the most important message that anybody can get. It's you're okay. And when you don't think you're okay, that's where all the problems start. The problems persist.
Right.
And move you in areas that you don't want to be in. Peter, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
It's deephappylife.com. Deephappylife.com. Everything about the book is there, where to order it. We're setting up workshops around the country. If you're interested in having a workshop, you know, email me through there, and we'll see if we can get something set up in your area. We're just beginning. The book is just out, and it's been very exciting. It's been so well received.
Wonderful. Hey, Peter,
deephappylife.com. Thank you, Michael. This has been great.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Marvin Wolf with us, Marvin J. Wolf with us. He's the author of The Tattooed Rabbi, a Rabbi Ben mystery. Over a career spanning 40 years, Marvin's written for television, penned a dozen nonfiction works, including the bestsellers Fallen Angels and Where White Men Fear to Tread. And this is his first novel. Marvin, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I think it's an interesting point. The mindset of a rabbi, and then to make a rabbi a detective, where did the idea come up with? I think it's great.
Well, it has its roots in a couple of different places. You remember that years and years ago, starting in the 60s, there was a guy who wrote a series of books about a mystery-solving detective, Rabbi David Small. In the mythical town of Barnard's Crossing, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And that was like the first rabbi detective. And it was very well received. I didn't want to do that kind of a book. And then you might recall that years and years ago, even before that, there was a television show, before that a radio show, called Have Gun, Will Travel.
Oh, by the way, do I have to admit, remember?
Say it again, please.
I said, do I have to admit that I remember watching the movie, the show?
No, you don't. You don't have to remember. You could say you read about it.
Yeah, good. My grandfather. Oh, yeah. It's around, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Have Gun, Will Travel was a story of it was set in the 1880s or 1890s, but the basic concept was you had a knight errant, a guy who went around doing good deeds. I don't think he did it for free.
No.
And my rabbi, in that way, is the same way. He goes around solving problems for mostly Jewish institutions, mostly for synagogues and universities and community centers, or anybody else who's got a problem that requires a lot of sensitivity and perhaps no police. And
okay,
he's actually, in a very tiny way, based on a real guy that I met when I was in the Army. I knew a chaplain who was the only Jewish chaplain to ever graduate from the Army Ranger School.
Yeah.
And probably the reason he was the only Jewish chaplain to ever do that is that he was, although he was an Orthodox rabbi and he stayed kosher, the Ranger School is a place where you basically live off the land and eat snakes for most of the three-week course. And he had such a will to do this that he carried his own food and never did eat snakes. He ran 5 miles every morning, and he was a little guy. I'm a little guy, but he was very muscular guy, ran 5 miles every morning, and just seemed like the most unusual rabbi I'd ever met. And I never forgot about him. So you put this all together, and we came up with Rabbi Ben.
Okay, now, the plots. That when we get into the plots in and of themselves, though obviously you know, we're going to talk about a series here because you can't just do one book. This guy's got to be, you know, he's got to move from book to book to book. But what's special about him? What makes him stand out from the crowd in addition to being a rabbi?
Well, he doesn't carry a gun. He is a martial arts artist. He would rather not resort to violence, but sometimes he has to. What makes him stand out is that he, more than anything, I suppose, is that he applies rabbinical reasoning, what they call Talmudic reasoning. There's a word for that, pilpul, to solving crimes. He looks at this things in an extraordinarily different way and sees not only what is there, but what is not there. I don't think I've seen that in another detective, another fictional detective, anyway.
Yeah, no. It sounds as though he's going to be just that much different than everyone else. As a matter of fact, if you watch all the detective movies and everything, the series that are going on TV right now, you see nothing like that. And I think it'd be a great series if you talked to anybody about doing that.
Well, not yet. The book has just been out since late last October, and it's just a little bit too soon for that. But yes, I would love to. There's actually a guy I know who writes for Royal Pains. He's actually a member of my synagogue, and I'm going to get him a copy of it. And I have a couple of other people in the business. But basically, the television people are looking for well-known properties, and this book is not yet well-known. That's why I'm one of the reasons why I'm doing your show, Michael.
Makes sense. Whereabouts in Los Angeles are you?
I'm very close to Santa Monica and Venice.
Okay, yeah. I was brought up in Los Angeles. As a matter of fact, I came from, and most people are getting the idea here, the most famous city in Southern California. Most famous city in Southern California. Did you ready for this?
Hollywood?
No. In the last 6 months. No, Bell, California. Bell, California is where...
Oh, Bell, the most infamous, you mean.
And the most infamous. Yeah, I was brought up there. Yeah.
Really? Bell?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
That was in the days when I was watching Have Gun Will Travel. I was brought up in the 50s there, you know, completely different. That's when they weren't paying the mayor and the rest of them $750,000 salaries, etc. We should have had the rabbi.
Paying the mayor anything. It was a once-a-month job.
Yeah, in those days, absolutely. Now, I was raised in the Los Angeles area. But when it really comes down to it, when you take a story like this and you really put it to work, how will I, and it's an interesting question, now, how will I see myself in that rabbi? What's going to make me recognize myself in that person?
That's a really good question. He's a conflicted guy. He's not a perfect guy. He's got his ideals. He tries to live up to them. He's not quite perfect. And, you know, he has his lapses. I'd like to think that all of us, most of us, maybe not Mr. Rizzo, the former mayor or city manager of Bell, but most of us, we try to do the right thing. And he's a guy who tries to do the right thing, even though a lot of temptation comes into his path. The other thing you might see in him is a really deep spiritual side. There are times in the book when he is not really sure that there is such a thing as God, but he's hedging his bets. He's not taking any chances. By the way, it's a little-known fact is you don't have to believe in God to be a rabbi. You just have to follow the commandments.
Interesting point. Never thought about that. There's a reason I'm asking that for recognition. For as many years as I've been in the communication field for just about, you know, as many years as you've been doing what you've been doing in TV, 40 years. And the one thing that I have learned, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, there is a recognizable, a familiar something that will cause a person to get tied to the story, stuck to the story. I remember the other night I was standing. Now, okay, let me put it this way. June 21st, 1960, I'm standing tall in San Diego boot camp, right? So MCRD, Marine Corps. If you want to know who I want for president, it's got to be John Wayne. So you, and I was brought up in the 50s. The Fonz lives in me, all right. That said, I'm watching. Remember An Affair to Remember, Cary Grant, Deborah Kerr? Remember the movie? Okay. I am sitting there by myself at about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. I'm crying my eyes out. Okay. Now, because of the way I think and all the experience I've had in whatever I do, I sat back and I said, okay, what is it? Why am I looking at her sitting on that couch and I'm crying? I'm not a painter. I'm not a singer. I'm not a what? And then it came to me very rapidly. She was crippled, and because of being crippled, she couldn't move forward. She couldn't get done what she wanted to get done. In her mind, her life was stopped. And I had to go back, and I had to say to myself, where in my life, where was I crippled? What do I recognize, you know, not physically, but emotionally, etc.? And I really believe, when it really comes down to it, what draws people to any kind of a story is when they see themselves within the context of the story, the content, and they begin to recognize themselves within familiar scenarios. It could be a familiar scenario where nobody thinks he's going to catch the bad guy. But how many times in your life have you got into situations where you knew you could do something, whether it was get a job or a relationship or something, and everybody was saying no? Unconsciously, that effectively, Marvin, is what connects us to those movies.
I think you're right about that. And I think now that we've put it in those terms, or you have, there is another thing about Rabbi Ben that makes people want to identify with him. He would really like to have his own synagogue. He'd like to have his own pulpit. But there's a reason, a deep, dark reason, that he doesn't tell people why that's probably never going to happen. So this is his way of working towards a goal that he knows he can never reach.
90% of the population out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, in their minds.
Yeah. There's always something we really wanted to do. Something happened to us. It was none of our own making. It just happened. And now an avenue is closed to us. We just can't do that.
Yeah.
My daughter, for example, is math challenged. She really, 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 really is afraid of math. And so far, she hasn't been able to overcome that so she can go and finish college. That's the only thing she needs is a particular math class, and she can go on and get her degree. I'm hoping she'll work her way through it, but it's the kind of thing that everybody has in their life, one way or another, and Rabbi Ben has it, too.
Yeah, and I really think that to capture it, I read the press release. I have the book in front of me. I just got the book, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But at the same time, that's what it's got to be, and that's what will attract most people. And if you look at every book that's ever been done, who was it? Wait just a second. Radio Susie, who did the Deep End of the Ocean? Who did we interview?
Jacqueline Michard.
Jackie Michard, okay. You know, she wrote The Deep End of the Ocean. So Jackie Michard was, she was in the studio two, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever it was. And we got into it, and The Deep End of the Ocean was very quickly about a group of women who went out on a ship and were on a vacation. Something happened to the crew, and now they were being chased by pirates, and they had no idea what to do. And as we got into it, and this is public knowledge, so I'm not speaking out of turn, we did it on the air. When we got down to it, she had been a housewife. She'd been a housewife that she cooked and she cleaned and she took care of the kids, and that was the end of it. Her husband passed away, and she didn't even know how to handle a checkbook. This all came out. And so what's the story about? Going out and surviving in the world. She just took her own story, framed it in such a way that it was externalized, and there it was for the world, and many, many people recognized the same thing. So when it really comes down to it, again, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, what the author does is that you, in this story of him, and the story of the rabbi, is you externalizing yourself through the character. Otherwise, you couldn't have written it.
I think you're right. This particular story, this particular book, once I made up my mind to do it and I cleared my schedule, it just poured out of me. I would dream every night, just vivid dreams, and I would get up at 6 or 6:30 and write for 4 or 5 hours, just straight. It just it would just pour it out of me. And I thought about it night and day, in the shower, when I was eating, in the car, all the time. I've never written a book this fast. Of course, I had to go back and do rewriting and polish. But the book, the story just poured out of me. And you're absolutely right. It's a great deal of, you know, my own wish fulfillment being projected into this. There's another dimension to the tattooed rabbi. We learned that Rabbi Benz lost his wife very early, and that he's never really gotten over it. And I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I didn't lose my wife in a bombing like he did, but I lost my wife.
Sure. And by the way, a bombing or whatever happens, it could be disease, whatever the case may be, you still lost. And that's the common denominator. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's the sense of loss. It's the sense of yearning and knowing that that's an empty space that's never quite going to be filled, even though he'd like to fill it.
Yeah. No, I know. I got it loud and clear. Let me ask you this, and this happens with all authors. When you decided to put it to pen and then you did what you did, writing for 4, 5, 6 hours, there's got to be that time, and it happens to everybody. There's that cathartic, that aha moment time when you realize something about the subject matter that you didn't realize before. Where was that for you?
Constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly. I realized, on one hand, just how human a rabbi has to be a rabbi, and how different they are as a group of people from most men. They're not perfect at all. I know a lot of rabbis, a few, 6 or 7 at least, and in my lifetime I've known many, many more, but I never really got into it this way, and it was the realization that he would be coming from a different place in many situations than most people would. That was the key to his character.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also called survival, and it's mental survival, and it's critical thinking. And I think a lot of the kids today, they don't get what you and I got in school. Critical thinking. How did you arrive at this? What did you do to get that answer? It's the texting and the calculators and the Blackberries and the rest of it. So there's that element that would also bring people back to recognition of a time gone by just in the process of the thinking.
That's true. And I also think that you plunge yourself into a mystery as a reader of the Tattooed Rabbi. You don't know where this is going to end. And as I'm writing it, I frankly didn't know where it was going to end either. I would come to a place in the story, and I'd say, well, what happens next? I don't know. Let's go have breakfast. And when I came back, I would know what happens next. I was just as surprised as the readers are going to be when they read it. That's the great adventure of being a writer. It's not just that you become the master of this little universe that you've created. That's a kick, too. But it's also that you're discovering this character right along with the reader as you create it. I really loved writing The Tattooed Rabbi. I think people would love reading it, too. I hope so, at least.
Yeah. No. And I got it loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time, but I know, you know, my mom's been gone since 1993, but I know one thing for sure. If she got a hold of something like this after she read it, she'd look at me and she'd say, "Oy vey, I loved it." Okay, Marvin, we got to go. Website we can find you at, please.
Very glad to be here. Thank you so much for putting me on your show, The Tattooed Rabbi.
Wonderful. Hey, Marvin, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. It's been a good show.
Thank you.
Take
care.
Good night.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new. I would spend it with you again, but now...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger. Dusty walls. People say.